Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Recording in progress.
I need somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now, but now these days are gone and I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind, I'm opening up the doors.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, right here on Revolution Radio, this 17th day of January, 2024. I will be joined today by Nick Colishan, professor of history of science from the UK, who's going to review the fictional story of the emergence and founding of Israel. It's going to be of great interest. There are many maps and images here, so you'll only fully appreciate what Nick has to say when you view the video version of the show. But before we get there, here are a couple new developments of considerable importance. Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps deploys to Yemen, now taking a direct role in Red Sea attacks. Members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard are in Yemen and assisting the Houthi rebel terror group in its ongoing assault on civilian shipping in the Red Sea. These attacks are affecting global shipping in the narrow sea that connects the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean by way of the Suez Canal, which has essentially become a bottleneck for vulnerable freighters. On Monday, a U.S.-owned ship was struck by a missile in the Gulf of Aden as it prepared to navigate. A cargo ship sustained damage and turned back to its point of origin. No one was injured, which was launched from the Yemen city of Aden. A second missile was fired but malfunctioned a day earlier. A similar attack was launched against a U.S. Navy ship, but it missed its target. U.S. forces, meanwhile, spent the weekend hitting targets inside Yemen using fighter jets and submarines. In my opinion, this was a colossal blunder because it's now made U.S. and since the U.K. were joining them and U.K. assets, targets for the Houthis, being supported by Iran, there's no end of damage to U.S. assets that's going to result from this calamitously stupid attack. Saudi Arabia was opposed to it, didn't want it to happen. And of course, they've been engaged in war with the Houthis for 7 or 8 years, negotiated a truce dividing Yemen, where the Houthis had the north, not oil rich, but enabled them to reestablish a democracy for which they've been fighting. Saudi, the south, which is oil rich, but where now even Saudi oil refineries are in jeopardy. The Houthis have long been linked to Iran, but according to the news outlet Semaphore, Iranian military officials are training them as they disrupt shipping and carry out missile and drone attack against Israel and its allies, now including the United States. And let me emphasize, what the Houthis have been doing after having declared war on Israel is completely in accordance with international law. They've been interdicting ships that were taking cargo to Israel. Those were the only ships they were interdicting. Not U.S., not other freighters, not other destinations, only those headed for Israel. Thus, by the U.S. and U.K. attacking Yemen for interdicting Israel, they have made themselves parties to the war. They have become allies of Israel and legitimate targets for Yemen, having declared war on Israel. The colossal stupidity of America in this matter boggles the mind. Semaphore reported. The IRGC has stationed missile and drone trainers and operators in Yemen, as well as personnel providing tactical intelligence support to the Houthis. Through its overseas Quad Force, the IRGC has overseen the transfer of attack drones, cruise missiles, and medium-range ballistic missiles using a string of strikes on Red Sea and Israeli targets. But bear in mind, they're attacking Israeli targets. Cargo ships bound for Israel. Totally legitimate. Totally appropriate. There's more about what's going on here and how Trump, in my opinion, stupidly had designated the Houthis as a terror group in the week before he left office in January 2021. Then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for whom I have no respect, described the Houthis as a deadly Iran-backed militia group, said designating as a terrorist organization would hold it accountable for its terrorist acts, including cross-border attacks, threatening civilian populations, infrastructure, and commercial shipping, PBS said at the time. Weeks later, the Biden admin removed the group from the government's list of terror organizations. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, I'm revoking the designation of Ansarallah, sometimes referred to as the Houthis, as a foreign terrorist organization. He said he was concerned designating the Houthis as a terrorist group risked depriving Yemen of food and fuel, citing information from the United States. He concluded the administration would seek a lasting political solution. He concluded the administration would seek a lasting political solution to the Iran-backed group's aggression in the region. Now, of course, that the Houthis have declared war on Israel, I'm sure Antony Blinken has changed his opinion. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary, UK in pre-war phase with several nations. This is where the United Kingdom is gearing up. As top official defended the decision to join the U.S. attacks on Yemen, British Secretary of Defense Grant Schnapps has informed Parliament of potential wars in the years to come with major nations, including Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Think about it. He described the situation as a pre-war phase, cautioning that wars with one or more of these nations could break out within the next 5 years. Britain, of course, would be directly involved. Russia seemed potentially the likeliest of the four as Britain continues to embroil itself in the Ukraine conflict, announcing an increase in military funding to help Ukraine purchase new military drones. In response, Russia directly warned British deployment of troops into Ukraine would be tantamount to a declaration of war. This is such a bad idea. Russia could take out the whole of the UK in a single strike. I mean, this is just ludicrous. In recent years, British officials have tried to spin the Russians as a direct threat to their interests. Historically, a Britain-Russia rivalry has often led to military conflict. Throughout the 19th century, there was ongoing conflict encapsulated as the Great Game between the British and Russian empires. Indeed, the colloquial term jingoism goes back to a British music hall song from the 1870s backing British intervention against Russia and Turkey. Britain has also sparred with Iran diplomatically, but has not been close to direct current conflicts with either China or North Korea. It may simply be that Schnapps is predicting U.S. hostilities that could quickly suck Britain in. The fact Britain goes wherever the U.S. leads means that should any of these wars of American intervention occur, there will likely be some British involvement. Though American officials warn of the potential for conflict with any or all of these nations, they generally don't put the wars on a five-year timetable. And by doing so, Shep seemed to suggest that Britain is, among NATO members, one of the more hawkish powers. Conspicuously absent from the list is Venezuela. Despite Britain's recent deployment of a small warship to the Guyan coast in an effort to assert Guyana's ownership of disputed oil-rich territory, a claim built around historic British colonial efforts in the region. Well, now, bear in mind, Colonel Douglas MacGregor, who is such an astute student of these matters, has now reflections on the very latest. Get this.
Is our Middle East strategy about to blow up in our faces? Do we even have a Middle East strategy at all? Our next guest just posted this on X and says, what happens in Gaza is not going to go away. It's left a permanent mark on the people of the region. They were told they too are animals. They deserve the worst, that they too deserve to be exterminated. They will not tolerate this. This is going to blow up in everyone's face. And over the past 24 hours, multiple missile strikes, massive strikes by Iran on Israeli Mossad targets in Iraq, claiming to have hit a Mossad headquarters. So shit has hit the fan by all accounts. And the man that predicted it is here with us right now, Colonel Douglas MacGregor. Colonel, welcome back to the show. I mean, you were spot on in what was about to happen here, blowing up in everyone's face. This sort of Mideast strategy by the Biden administration doesn't appear to be a strategy at all. What is your assessment over the past 24 hours of these massive strikes?
Well, I don't think it's an accident that these strikes were launched during the Iowa caucus period.
Thank you.
I think these strikes are meaningful on multiple levels.
That's fine.
First of all, you had very precise targeting and the use of extremely effective precise ballistic missiles that penetrated all the air defense networks that exist on our side and in Iraq, in Syria, and so forth. So they managed to get these missiles through. And if you look at the targets, one, it was a house that contained a Mossad agent. He happens to be Kurdish. But he's a Mossad agent working for the Israelis and his family in that house. And as far as I know, he and his family members were vaporized. People initially tried to argue it was a strike against us. No Americans were targeted. All the targets were related to Israeli operatives, Kurdish operatives, and ISIS operatives up in Syria who were involved in the killings, the killings of the leading figures in Lebanon by the Israelis. And the killings of Iranian troops in Syria. So this was not accidental. It was carefully planned. And remember, the Iranians had said that there will be a reckoning. We will strike back. And they did nothing for, you know, some period of time. And then suddenly, right on schedule with the caucus, you get these very precise missile strikes. On another level, they were trying to demonstrate, if you think we're a pushover, if you want to go to war with us, understand something. We can do this all over the region, particularly in Israel. And they have an enormous missile arsenal that could level Israeli cities. And they know that the next step towards escalation, which is what the Israelis are doing, and we've now escalated in support of them against Yemen, is to attack Hezbollah or precipitate a conflict with Hezbollah that allows the Israelis with support from us to go in and obliterate most of southern Lebanon. And they've simply said, you know, we're going to be in a position to strike back, and it will be something that you're not prepared for. That was the message. So this is another step. I should say not a step, but we're sliding further down the mountainside into the ravine of despair and war. And there is no strategy. Our strategy in the Middle East is to do exactly what Mr. Netanyahu wants us to do. That's all. He has far more influence in Washington than Biden. And Biden has said, yes, send them. Yes, yes, yes. Remember, Biden, if you go back and look at him in the past, he had a number of red lines in Eastern Europe. He said, well, we're not going to give the Ukrainians any of our tanks. We're not going to give the Ukrainians rocket artillery. We're not going to give the Ukrainians X, Y, Z. We're not going to give them any tactical ballistic missiles. We're not going to do these things because it would mean World War III. It could mean World War III. What's he done? He's crossed all of those red lines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, none of it has worked. and Ukraine is finished. It's prostrate. Millions of people have left the country. The country is in abject poverty. The government is criminal in terms of its corruption and behavior. It's more oppressive than any other government in the region. And yet we continue to feed this myth that somehow or another this is a fight for freedom. It has nothing to do with it. It's all a fight to harm Russia, which hasn't worked. But no one wants to admit that. Though you go to the Middle East, one war is winding down. The new war is ramping up. And there are people who think that if we provide enough air and naval power to the Israelis and some special ops forces, that they can pretty much do whatever they want, and they can dominate the same old Arabs and Turks and Iranians that they've always dominated. Wrong. The region has changed, and it's enraged.
In Washington, of course, the argument is that it's in our strategic interest to assist Israel in this massive military way. It's in our strategic interest to do all of that. John Mearsheimer, in his book, The Israel Lobby, argues, greatly researched, that it's absolutely not in our American interest to do anything. Every time we bomb a Middle Eastern country, it comes back to bite us in the ass. 2 days ago, President Biden said at a public event, he was asked about whether or not Iran would attack us and be involved in this. And he said, I've delivered a clear message to Iran. They're not going to do anything. And 24 hours, 48 hours later, we see this. So who's running the show here? I mean, it seems to me that Biden is out to lunch. He's a puppet. He's not running anything.
Well, I think Mr. Netanyahu is ultimately in charge. And remember, he's an extraordinarily intelligent man. I think he's a bit deranged when it comes to the future of his own country and the region. But he's in charge, and his agents on the Hill are in charge. And who are these? I mean, Lindsey Graham, it's bombs away. Let's flatten Yemen, and then let's fly on to Iran and flatten Iran. There are problems with all of these things because Iran is a far stronger, more capable and technologically sophisticated state today than it was 30 or 40 years ago. The same thing is true for Turkey. The same thing is true for the Arab states. There is a reportedly some sort of firefight that's gone on along the border between Gaza and Egypt, between Egyptian troops and Israelis. I don't know what this means. I don't know what will happen, but the whole region is on tenterhooks. It's ready to explode. And the people in charge in many of these countries like Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Jordan, Egypt, they don't want a war. Of course they don't want a war. But if they don't act decisively against the Israelis, their populations will remove them. That's where we're headed. We're going to start to see governments tumble. Because this is a regional matter, as you pointed out at the beginning. You can't say the things and then do the things that they've done without precipitating this hostility and this response. And Iran, of course, knows we've been talking about attacking them for years. So this was a message that said, don't do it. If you do it, we're prepared. We will fight, and it will be devastating. And by the way, has anybody thought about the consequences for the oil and gas industry and the distribution of energy coming out of the region, its impact on the whole globe? I haven't heard any. Do people understand that this will disrupt supply chains, that this could tank economies? And then there sit the Chinese, who absolutely want nothing to do with a war with anybody under any circumstances. And they are acutely dependent not only on the oil and gas coming out of the Persian Gulf, but on food from West Africa. What are they going to do? I think the Chinese will reluctantly join with the Russians, and they will back whomever we attack, and ultimately probably will be drawn in some fashion. So then I worry about the nuclear dimension, which a lot of people sort of dismiss out of hand. But I'm not worried about us. I'm worried about the Israelis and their readiness to use that. And that's a fear in the region. And that fear precipitates what? The development or the acquisition of nuclear capabilities by others, the Turks, the Iranians, potentially even the Saudis. So, this thing is out of control. We have no strategy. We haven't defined our interests. And we have always been in a position to pick up the phone and call and say, stop. If you don't stop, we'll end all supplies to you immediately and withdraw all of our forces. That's not going to happen because Mr. Netanyahu really is in charge.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. Spot on, as always. The man who predicted it, Colonel Douglas McGregor, thank you, as always, for joining us. We really appreciate your insights. Is our middle...
Well, I'm pleased that Nick Goldstrom is here now. Nick, your own UK defense secretary has announced to Parliament a list of five different nations, including Britain and China and Yemen, as potentially targets for war that were in a pre-war footing. The report here of Colonel McGregor was about Iran becoming more actively involved, that Iran is now in Yemen. Iran is assisting the Yemeni, that between Iran and the Houthis, they have complete control of the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, that all the tankers are no longer willing to run the risk because, whereas heretofore, the Houthis were only targeting Israeli-bound ships. This colossally stupid attack by the U.S. and the U.K. on the Houthis has now made them complicit and parties to the war and therefore legitimate targets for the Houthis. Nick, I think this was as stupid as it gets. And he was also reporting that the Iranians have sent very precise missiles into Syria, I think also Lebanon, to take out with precision Israeli-based assets, including spies for Israel. I mean, it's fascinating that Iran is now beginning to flex its muscles and telegraph that if you're going to mess with us, we have the ability to strike with precision anywhere in the Middle East. I think this is another turning point, Nick. Your thoughts?
Oh, well, Jim, I thank you for asking me. I haven't really got much I can add to this, Jim. I was sort of prepared or hoping we could do a historical review of...
We're going to, Nick. The first 30 minutes I introduced the latest news, that's all. We've got you...
Oh, okay.
You're all lined up for the presentation on the fictional history of the emergence of Israel. Hoping to elicit any comments you had on these late breaking news developments.
Well, my country, Britain, always seems to be figuring out what it can do to start World War III. And I don't think it considers at all what the repercussions of triggering war and conflict. I think its politicians will do what they're told by, you're never quite sure who, American or Israeli sources. We'll just control it, and we are just sort of defending Israel. I think it's absolutely disgraceful and shameful. I don't know anybody who supports my country's position on this, but it's what you get in the media. It's what you get in papers, on the radio, of support. And anyone it wants to attack, it will call terrorists. Oh, we're bombing terrorists, sure. It's rather horrific, but I don't see anything of coherent thought of where this will lead to. I mean, obviously, I agree with everything Douglas McGregor says, which I think any thinking person must surely agree with him. And I mean, how is it possible? I mean, my country seems to be supporting two different genocides. First of all, in Ukraine, the attempt to wipe out the traditional ancient culture of Russia in East Ukraine, which led to this conflict, and Russia is defensively trying to protect and maintain that ancient culture, and it's succeeding. And now Israel literally completing the wipeout of Semitic people in Palestine, this last little bit, Gaza, the last little part of Palestine, where after Israel has eradicated literally hundreds of different towns and villages throughout Palestine, as it takes over the land, it demolishes the houses, demolishes the olive groves, kills the men, and the women and children are herded into Gaza. That's what Gaza is. It's an open-air prison where all the people taken out from towns and villages their ancestors lived in, herded into this one little place, and now Israel enjoys exterminating them. And it's so inhuman. People wonder, are these people really human in Israel? How is such cruelty possible? How is it that the majority of the Israel population endorse and rejoice this total extermination program? I mean, the people in Israel, I don't think they've got any real legitimate right to be there. They've got a bogus historical claim. They are invaders concerned to eradicate the local population. And obviously this enrages Muslims all around the area, as it should do. I suppose it will lead to some major conflict, unless Russia has got some way of being ultra cool and careful, which Putin does have a reputation of being that, unless there's any way he can defuse the situation. I think that Iran, Russia and China are quite very careful actors in the region. I don't think any of them want a conflict as such, but they're being under unbearable pressure from America and Israel, and also Britain too, which is joining in. As Douglas McGregor says, nobody can see what this will lead to at the moment. Right.
Well, it is a bloody shame, but as I've many times observed, if you envision Bibi Netanyahu, who is the commander-in-chief of the United States, and you can understand our foreign policy going all out for Ukraine, seeking to defend its borders when the U.S. isn't defending its own, and in Israel with a slaughter of the Palestinians, which we could cut off at any moment we chose because they're using American weapons to carry it out. And on the other hand, George Soros is our domestic president, where the open borders, the lawlessness, the legalizing shoplifting up to 950, defunding the police, all the woke ideology that's creating chaos in our schools are just what Soros would like to see as a recipe for destroying America, which has been his dream to see America destroyed before he dies, Nick. These are two of the great evil figures that are populating Earth today, where we'd be so much better off without them. But there they are. Their malevolent influence continues.
If only America would take more seriously the 9/11 truth message we gave them, which we formulate.
Stand by. We'll be right after this with Nick Holmstrom.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Ah. join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And I do want to remind everyone that Revolution Radio is listener supported. So if you go to revolution.radio, you have the opportunity to make a contribution. I'm so extremely pleased to have Nick Kohlstrom with me here today, where Nick is one of the leading experts on the history of Israel and a whole host of related issues. I featured him before on the just war Russia is fighting against Ukraine, for example. But he's done absolutely sensational work on a wide range of other issues. He's a leading expert on the London 7-7 subway bombing, for example, where his book Terror on the Tube is now in our 7th or 8th printing or edition. Nick, it's been absolutely sensational what you've done there. And on a host of other issues, today we're talking about the history of Israel, which is largely encapsulated by mythology. Nick, give us a start here about the fictional history of Israel.
Right, Jim. Okay, well, I'm a science historian, but I feel it behoves all of us to struggle to get some picture of what has happened in the Holy Land. And I want to look at how when the Jews after World War II were given Israel, nobody had quite the idea, the understanding people have today of what had really happened in the Holy Land. And let's see if we can try to get a bit of a picture. Now, this shows you what initially, in 1948-47, Israel became, what Jews were given. And just meditate for a while, this dark green area, what a very, very strange boundary it is to be given. Why would anyone choose or design to have a country of that shape? Now, we're looking at the next slide, at the way the ancient Israel was part of the land west of the Jordan River, that it was not given. It did not take that land. If we go back a minute to the earlier slide, Jim. It's got a perimeter all the way around that it's given. You see on the west coast there of the Mediterranean, what we now call Gaza, the Gaza Strip, you can see that's not part of Israel. You can see it's got a huge chunk of the Sinai Desert. Well, why is it given all that? What's that got to do with them? Why would they have any claim to that? So it's a huge chunk of the desert, and the whole middle ground, which was left to the Palestinians, without access to the sea, which is extremely strange. Why would they be given that? And it's hard to avoid the impression that their intention here was to gradually take over that middle ground, which is what they've done ever since, of course. They've gradually moved in on that middle ground, and obviously want to take all of it. So on the basis of an event which I would argue never happened in World War II, they had the sympathy of the world, and they could claim, oh, we want Israel, and we have a right to take over it, because some couple of thousand years ago, there was a land called Israel over there. Okay, next slide. Now, notice here that the two seas, the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River connecting them, and on the west of that Jordan River, I'd like you to notice the First of all, there's Galilee, which is west of the Sea of Galilee. That's where Jesus' disciples came from. South of that is what is called Israel on this map, although it was often known as Samaria. And also, the ancient Assyrians call it Omri, or Kingdom of Omri. He was the first, he was the king there. The Omrides, Kingdom of Omri, Samaria. And it's called here Israel. Generally speaking, I'd like to argue that Israel, ancient Israel, was a people rather than a nation. Okay? But there is Israel. And no, hang on, we haven't finished. And south of Israel is Ephraim. See the Ephraim. And then south of that is Judea. And you can see Jerusalem. Can you see it around Jerusalem, Bethlehem, around what is called Judea? Now, Judea lasted quite a bit longer than Israel. And Israel, when it existed, this is in the 9th century BC, that's 29 centuries ago, okay? Or is it 28? 29 centuries ago. So this is a long time ago we're looking at. And Israel was a lot stronger than Judea, partly because the land was more fertile. And it was quite military. It had charioteers, and it made the mistake of challenging the Assyrian Empire and was therefore defeated, and it was swallowed up by the Assyrian Empire in 722 BC. So remember that date. Israel vanishes forever at 722 BC, okay? And Judea carries on for another century or so after that. So the Old Testament text starts to be written in Judea after Israel has disappeared. The country was called Israel. And Hebrews then migrate south from Israel to Judea. Judea starts to grow stronger, and Jerusalem becomes a big center of Judea. It starts to become powerful around about the 7th century BC. Okay, now we're going to see the legends that imagined, terrific legends of David and Solomon in 10th century BC are imagined. This is a history, a retrospective history to create a glorious past. And let's look what actually existed. So now we're at an earlier period of time that we've just looked at. Okay, this is the ancient Empire of Egypt. This is the Bronze Age. Right, the Bronze Age, and it's earlier than what we just looked at. This is the world's first empire, and the terrific conquest. It's called the 18th Dynasty of Egypt, and it went from the Nile to the Euphrates River, and extended right through. You can see right through the whole of Palestine, or Cana, Syria, Sinai, desert, Egypt, Libya. It was a terrific empire, and it was wonderfully prosperous, and that is what's remembered as the Golden Age of Egypt. Okay, and we'll see in that 10th century BC, there is imagined in Palestine to have existed this kingdom of David and Solomon. Okay, now so this is here we are. It says King David's empire. And this is in a couple of books of the Old Testament, that David went out and established an empire from the Nile to the Euphrates. Okay, now it's important to let's say it's an achievement of revisionist historians in the last 50 years or so, or perhaps let's say this century, to discover, without any doubt, that this empire never existed. So this is a fictional, phantom fact story we're looking at here, of David and Solomon as having some huge empire. And this is a Bible-based map on what supposedly existed. And you get I recommend anything written by Finkelstein, Professor Israel Finkelstein, who's a Hebrew professor at a university in Israel, and he's written various books He spent a lifetime digging up archaeology of the Holy Land. The point is that once Jews got access, after 1967, they had access to all around Judea and Jerusalem, and non-stop they would be digging up. It's the most archaeologically dug up part of the whole world, okay? They were endlessly trying to unearth, endlessly with one thing in mind, that wanted to find evidence for King Solomon, for his temple, for his empire, for King Solomon's gold, for King Solomon's horses, King Solomon's archers, King Solomon's mines, anything of the great, glorious story of King Solomon. Not a trace, absolutely nothing. It's important to ascertain that this is a result of half a century of Jews taking hold of the Holy Land, claiming they had a right to possess it, then digging up and not confirming their own story. So I think this is a tremendous epic part of the modern world, that Jews came to Israel and desperately searched for a confirmation of their Bible narrative and failed to get it. Well, they did find all around Judea, everywhere they dug up, they found little goddess figurines. They found about 3,000 of them altogether, just about every site they dug up. So this is a devoutly goddess-oriented culture up to about at least BC 600, a goddess-worshipping culture. And they really didn't find, one exception, any evidence of this Yahweh-type god anywhere. It just wasn't there, right? So I think let's absorb the fact that this revision of history has taken place, and I beg any Christians listening to this to take on board that their terrific story of David and Solomon, which is in churches all over the world, Christian churches, that is a fictional narrative. David did probably exist as some sort of maybe a duke with a following, a couple of hundred or so people followed him, roamed around the place. But you can't have any kingdom. This 10th century BC, there were no kingdoms in Palestine. Okay? The place was too poor. And here we are, this terrific image, Temple of Solomon.
Gregory, I'm on the hour. I'll call you at my first break. Top of the hour.
This is the great dream, as described in the Book of Chronicles of Kings, the mighty, and gold-plated, wonderfully gold-plated all over the place. And what I'm saying is that this is a memory. There were Hebrews, this is before anyone was a Jew, there were Hebrews in Egypt, okay? And they remembered the glorious temples, which did really exist, totally plated with gold, shimmering in the sunshine, amazing, glorious gold-plated temple, gold and silver, electrum, plated with gold, and absolutely splendid. Egypt was a place where gold was plentiful, you see. And the Hebrews they were over there. If you think of what is called the Exodus, there were some of them that wasn't that far away, 150 miles, went from Egypt, from Canaan to Egypt and back again. And so they carried with them the memory of this glorious temples of Egypt, and they reproduced it in this whole story of the Temple of Solomon. Pretty well everything about the Temple of Solomon is an echo and a memory of the glorious Temple of Egypt. I think, except that they had loads, imagine loads of animal sacrifice going on in the Temple of Solomon, which Egyptians didn't do. Apart from that, most of the things are regarded as being an echo of that Egyptian, of one of the Egyptian temples in the glorious 18th dynasty, especially around the time of Akhenaten, which is when monotheism began. Okay, somehow they imagined monotheism, or they took with them memory of monotheism and the temples which they saw at that time. So that's my suggestion of what the Temple of Solomon in the Old Testament really was. Okay. Right, here's another one. What was in the Temple of Solomon? Well, it didn't really exist. At that time, the 10th century, let's be clear why it didn't exist. Partly there'd been a terrific drought for a couple of centuries called Mycenaean drought, and a whole lot of towns and villages had kind of dried up, agriculture had stopped working, a whole lot of honest farmers all around Judea are turned into what's called Habiru, which is very disreputable people, the Habiru, who became the Hebrews. Habiru meant mercenaries for hire, soldiers for hire. They had a very sort of bad reputation because they couldn't make a living any longer with agriculture in that area. It was such an awful drought. And let's bear in mind that Jerusalem is not on any, doesn't have fertile land around it. It doesn't have any running water by it. It's just on the peak of a mountain. It's not a place you might naturally occur to have a city there. So it was hardly inhabited at that time, the 10th century. Okay, and it certainly wasn't any kingdom there. The kingdom didn't appear until maybe two or three centuries later. Some century, it was a real capital city. Okay, all right, here is the Bible story and the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem. Overall, Israel was 40 years. So I'm putting it to you that Solomon didn't exist. And Jerusalem never reigned over Israel. Israel was way north of Jerusalem. The fantasy here, if you'll forgive me saying this, in the Old Testament, is the idea of a vast empire from the Nile to the Euphrates, and that is Israel. That is the Bible story. And for many centuries, or maybe a thousand years, people believed in what they call a greater Israel, which was this imaginary huge empire, which is actually the Empire of Egypt, in fact, okay? And this imaginary empire, and then the story is that greater Israel split up into Judea and Israel at some point. So that is the kind of narrative you get from Bible sources. And I'm saying, well, I'm echoing what modern historians like Thomas Thompson and Finkelstein say. For example, here's the book, The Mythic Past, Mythic Past by Thomas Thompson. I think he's a very good American revisionist. And here is Israel Finkelstein, David and Solomon. These kind of books, I think they're very sound, absolutely honest. That's the thing. They're honest revisionist sources. That's our best reconstruction of past history. And I'm urging Christians and Christians to give up this story. It really didn't happen. Okay, maybe a great story, but there never was such an empire in that time. Okay, so this is the result of excavating the Holy Land with terrific intensity and dedication, and most famous king in the world, probably King Solomon. He fades into being a myth, a story. If I make a comparison, it's like King Arthur in England, ruler of England. Historians have to place the fact, which was created to give a glorious past to the English monarchy, okay? We have to face the fact that he was not a king of England. He was actually some king of Wales in the 5th century, and that isn't quite so romantic, right? So we have to face the fact that this King Solomon, the word is a made-up name. It's to do with the sun, echoes of solar themes in it. The glorious sun king called Amenhotep, he was like the Louis XIV of ancient Egypt, the glorious sun king. And this myth is a kind of echo of his life. And for example, King Solomon lived peacefully for 30 years without war. That applies to Amenhotep, this pharaoh Amenhotep, the great, who lived in a peaceful empire which had been established, the great empire from the Nile to the Euphrates. So this becomes a myth, and we have to accept. And it's nowadays used for Jews claiming they got some right to expand the borders of Israel. Jews nowadays try to pretend that, oh yes, we got great Israel, which we used to have in the past. No, you didn't. There never was any such greater Israel in the past. Then it simply did not exist. I think it's terribly important for the world to adjust to this fact and not let anyone in Israel use a bogus history as an as a justification for taking over other people's land. Right. Thank you. Okay. Next. Right. Here's a very good book about reviewing by a Muslim reviewing the history of Palestine, Masala, and he's at a lecture at London University. So let me just read out. Or do you want to read it out, Jim?
Sure. After more than 150 years and thousands of biblical excavations carried out in and around the Old City and Jerusalem, there is still no material history or archaeological or empirical evidence for the Kingdom of David from 1000 B.C. The reason for the lack of any material or empirical evidence for the Kingdom of David and Solomon and other mega-narratives of the Old Testament is simple. These are invented traditions. Masala, 2007, 2013. The Kingdom of David, as a large and influential polity, was probably based on a small tribal leader in Judea, the latter, a name which appears in Assyrian sources in the course of the 8th and early 6th century B.C. This lack of material or empirical evidence for a United Kingdom of David and Solomon is almost universally recognized by archaeologists in the West and also by some leading Israeli archaeologists from Masala's Palestine, a 4,000-year history.
Right. Okay. So as he says, David was a small tribal leader in Judea. You know, I think that's a very fair assessment. So he did at least exist, and we know he existed because subsequent kings of Judea traced their ancestry from him. They said from the house of David. So that is really the main evidence that he actually existed. Okay, right, next. So what Jerusalem really was in that period, the Bible's history, here we are, the Bible history, how writers create a past. I recommend this revisionist historian facing the facts of what really happened. In the 10th century, during the couple of centuries, this very severe drought, Mycenaean drought, the end of the Bronze Age, Jerusalem was hardly inhabited at all. It had been a small market town, and it first acquired the status of a city in the middle of the 7th century. So it was, as it were, you could call it a capital city. Bear in mind, what was then Judea was an Assyrian vassal state on the fringe of empire. So the kings described in the Old Testament, insofar as they may have existed, there was not an independent nation. It was a vassal state within the Assyrian Empire, which obviously doesn't say in the Bible. In the Bible, it doesn't really mention that Canaan was a kind of suburb or district of the Egyptian Empire in the 10th century. It just misses that out completely. So I think this is a realistic perspective that Judea in these centuries was within the Assyrian Empire. Okay, right, next. Okay, another Tom Thompson about why these mega narratives cannot possibly have happened. Let's read it. The early period in which the traditions have set their narratives is an imaginary world of long ago. It never existed as such. In the real world, only a few dozen very small scattered hamlets and villages supported farmers in the Judean highlands. They numbered hardly more than 2,000 persons. So they could just about do timber, grazing and grazing lands, and there could not be a kingdom for any Saul or David to be king of, simply because there are not enough people. The state of Judah did not yet exist. There's no political force anywhere in Palestine. developed enough to be capable of unifying many economies and regions of this time. So if it existed at all, it was still centuries from having the capacity of challenging any of the dozens of more powerful towns of Palestine. So there were other towns, like Samaria, for example, that was a main city that did have a temple, right? Samaria, I think Megiddo also, from which Armageddon comes, Megiddo, that had a temple, but not Jerusalem. So Jerusalem did not become important a century later. Okay, now this is one of the, I think, two bits of evidence for any David character having existed. There's three letters in this ancient Aramaic alphabet which allude to the House of David. House of David. So I think this is way north, somewhere up around the Sea of Galilee, where it was found. So this can be interpreted as indicating that the character David really existed. So there's a terribly small amount. Here is a narrative which I much recommend for anyone about who David really was, by a Hebrew professor. I think he lectures in New York, or a professor of historical Israeli history, he describes David as having quite a knack for taking other people's wives, tendency to change sides during wars, as someone who could hardly be trusted because of his tendency to flip over with, I think it's with the Philistines, be on their side and then change over. And here is Israel.
Nick, hold that thought. We'll return with Nick Colliston on the fictional history of Israel right after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, my special guest today, Nick Kohlstrom, who is an internationally recognized expert in the history of science, is giving us a very meticulous, thorough, detailed exploration of the legendary history of Israel, which contains many, many fictional, illusory elements, some of which are derived from the Bible, which, of course, assuming Nick has it right, and I have no doubt, means we have here some statements in the Bible are provably false. Now, I offer that only because there are those who tend to believe the Bible is literally true, despite the fact that it contains many contradictions, inconsistency, biological and historical impossibilities. Nick, please do continue with this masterful dissection of the history of Israel.
Well, Jim, we somehow Israel did really exist as a people. I mean, the very earliest mention of Israel, I think, is in the 19th dynasty of Egypt. It's on some clerk of a pharaoh. So they were a people, and they were in the Holy Land, and they historically got wiped out as a nation, 722 BC. And then in Christian texts, they're referred to as more as a people than as a nation. And we're mainly concerned, I think, now with the modern state of Israel claiming it has a right to have land and territory. I think that's our central theme today. And I'm trying to look at what in the past, if anything, validates that. OK, now here is a top Israeli expert, Israel Finkelstein, making a comment about David. He was not a king. There was no kingdoms. He was maybe some sort of mafia boss or duke. And say, so I like this phrase, whether by cunning. Oh, you read it out, Jim. Just read it out for us.
Whether by cunning intelligence or extraordinary historical circumstance, he alone, of all the now forgotten ruffians and freebooters who roamed the rugged country between the Dead Sea and the Judean foothills, established a dynasty that ruled for the next 400 years. Israel Finkelstein, David and Solomon, page 59.
Right, so that dynasty was in Judea, right? And the kingdom of Judea did continue long after Israel had been wiped out. Okay, next. Right, now, let's move on now to Jerusalem. This is ancient, a picture of the ancient city of Jerusalem, Old David City. You see here it's walled, shows something called the Gihon Spring, which is absolutely essential for its survival. It's the one source of fresh water, a spring, and behind it what's called Mount Moriah. Okay, so that's a picture of what is imagined to have been the old city of David. Okay, next. Right, now we come on now to the picture which we're given today of what's imagined to have been Solomon's temple, which I argue has never existed. And in all sorts of books and stories, the kingdom of the Temple of Solomon is imagined to have been on what is called this Temple Mount, which exists today, a 36-acre, almost square or rectangular, vast building to the northern part of the city of Jerusalem. And you see here the Western Wall. That's the wall that everybody prays to today. You get thousands of people praying and stuffing paper prayers into the wall of the Western Wall. So that's the main bit you see about today. But also there's Israeli mosque has been built on this Temple Mount. And so there's a whole storm around it. If Jews say they want to rebuild their Solomon's temple, and I imagine they have to knock down the Islamic mosque to build it, right? It sounds kind of funny, but I suppose it isn't really. Okay, next. Now here's a Christian Bible vision of the temple, and it's got Fort Antonia, which Hadrian built, and he built it for the 10th Legion. 10th Legion had to keep an eye on Jerusalem, and there was up to about 10,000 Romans dwelt in this Fort Antonia. And I would say the whole surface you're looking at there was covered with all sorts of tents and buildings for Roman occupation. I'd say that's why it's built. And it was built at the top of a mountain, Mount Moriah, okay? And Romans always built their forts on the top of a mountain, or the highest part of any locality. They always put their forts there, and that's why this Roman fort was put there, okay? Whereas no Hebrew temple was ever built on the top of a mountain, so why it wasn't there, okay? Anyway, this is... imagines Sanhedrin buildings. Okay, here is in the corner, Wikipedia is imagining, in the corner of this Temple Mount, it's imagining the Fort Antonia, which is where the Romans dwelt. Now, the idea that Temple Mount would be built, and then a little fortress on the corner would be where the Romans dwelt. What kind of sense does that make? Why would they want to put themselves in a little corner? And how could this temple be built on this Temple Mount? You see pictures of an imaginary, either Solomon's Temple, or it's a rebuilt Solomon's Temple, not clear what, right in the middle of this Temple Mount building. Well, at what period of history could such a temple have existed, given that this huge Temple Mount was built by Romans? I don't think there's any doubt that Romans built this. Okay, next. Right, here's another one. I think this is from an Israeli museum. It's showing you this Fort Antonia with an imaginary temple. Now, they're supposed to be two temples. There's supposed to be Solomon's temple, which is then destroyed in the Bible. It describes how this one was destroyed by some pharaoh quite soon after. And then Jews were taken off into captivity, and they then rebuilt their temple a second time. And then that was then destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. And now Jews are planning, or claim to be planning, to build a third temple, which is pretty well where you see it here. This diagram might be an imaginary picture of where they want to build their third temple. That might be the idea. They want to plonk it on top of this this temple mount that the Romans built. And it has to be there. It has to be there, because that's where they imagine the original Solomon's temple was. Okay. Now, here is the vast, mighty wall, the very awesome wall, which the Jews really came across in 1967 when they stormed in, they took over Jerusalem from Muslims, pushed the Muslims out. And this awesome wall was kind of, well, people knew it was there, but it was became really exposed and center stage from 1967 onwards. And why does anyone want to pray to a wall? Because a lot of people do, right? Jews are specifically told in their sacred texts not to pray to anything made out of stone or wood, but there seems to be an exception. And they seem to imagine that somewhere behind that is the remains of Solomon's temple. Well, no, it's not there. Only behind that is what you might call Mount Moriah. That's the top. Jerusalem runs a lot. Jerusalem is built on this mountain, fairly low ridge of a mountain ridge, which reaches its highest point, Mount Moriah, just where this Fort Antonia is. Okay, so the only thing behind this is the tip of Mount Moriah, which is why the huge Temple Mount is built there. So slightly misleading term, very misleading Temple Mount, because there was no temple there at all.
Nick, do we have an idea of how this wall, which is very imposing, came to be built?
Well, I'll come on to that. I would say there were origins of it that were megalithic. That was prehistorical, or some forgotten era of history. Supposedly Hadrian built this. It's quite mysterious who did build. You can see the highest level, you can see smaller bricks, right?
Yeah.
And then you see the very large bricks lowered down. This is what makes it so awesome, why people want to pray to it, because the bricks are so huge. And then if you go down lower still, which I'll be coming to, the bricks are even more gigantic and vast. So there's something very primordial about this. It's the huge bricks that make you feel it so primordial. All we're really concerned about in this presentation is that Jews had nothing whatsoever to do with creating this wall or with this Temple Mount, and their temple is not behind it. So it's simply, it just isn't there. Okay, so people come wanting to pray to this wall. Okay, this I think it's men only prayers. I think it's just males allowed to come along okay, next. Right, now, here we see it reckons the first seven layers are from the Herodian period, that Herod built it. And there are a load of underground courses, so the part of the extraordinary ancient history of Jerusalem, the level of ground we're at now, you see here, is not the original ground level. It goes much deeper. And if you go to Jerusalem, try and get permission to go on a tour under this. You can go under this level and see the primordial huge stones. I wish I could do that. Yeah. Okay, next. Here they are, about 800 ton stones, cut, lifted, and moved at with right angles. The only other place with stones likewise cut, lifted, stones are at Baalbek in Lebanon, and possibly also in Egypt, some culture that had these absolutely vast stones. So I would say this is pre-Roman culture did this. So I would say that the very earliest mention in the Bible, which is about Abraham and Isaac going to this site, or alluding to this site, that there were megalithic remains. But also partly the reason Jerusalem became a sacred site, even though it's not no fertile land near from it, it would have been because it had some sort of imposing megalithic remains. Let me just suggest that as why it was a sacred spot. Okay, next. So this is another group of people looking at these vast stones. Okay, next.
Don't you imagine those little notches must be where they were in inserting, say, wood or something in order to carry it?
Exactly, yeah. There was some wooden apparatus there where they got notches, yeah.
And they had to have a vast number of individuals to move these huge stones. I mean, Nick, hard to imagine how it was done.
So it certainly is, yeah. Quite a mystery, yeah. Okay, so this is part of the awesome thing of going to Jerusalem. You see these, somebody could make and design and carve and lift these vast stones and make them part of the architecture. As part of the ancient history. Okay, next. So now we come on to this mystery of the this Temple Mount, which has the Islamic Dome of the Rock put onto it now, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque built there. So you get all three monotheistic religions have got a claim to this Temple Mount area. And Jews are trying to claim that it's somehow theirs. They've got a right to take it over as if they somehow own it. So I want to stress that we should agree with the Islamic perspective that Jews have got nothing whatsoever to do with this huge, expanse. It was, as I said, a Roman fortress, 10th Legion, according to the Bible story, it's where Jesus would have been taken when he was being interrogated by Pontius Pilate, who would have stood somewhere in the middle there. There was, in the first century, there was a Christian monument there to honour that. It was a little octagon, some sort of octagon shrine, where the story was Jesus was stood there to be interrogated, and then later on, when Islam developed, it knocked down that octagonal shrine and built its own larger octagonal shrine in that same spot. So, and they've got a story about Muhammad and the some sort of heavenly tour he had when he touched down right here. So, all three monotheistic religions are putting in a claim to this area. The Dome of the Rock, and it's something that the question is, great question, can it be shared out amongst the different monotheistic religions? That's the question. Next. Right. This is the flashpoint, possible start of World War III, if Jews want to build this temple on an imaginary basis of a ancient temple which never existed there at all. There was a temple there, and they want to knock down the Islamic mosque in order to build what they think was there. So there was a Jewish temple. It was in the city of Jerusalem, in the old city. It's important to appreciate in the story of Jesus walk and his disciples walk past this temple. They admire how good it looks because Herod did it all up. Herod really refurbished the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, made it look really smart. But that was within the old city, as we'll see. Come on, next. Right. Here is what is there at the moment. This terrific, splendid Islamic mosque. And Jews are trying to claim, make a quite false claim, that they somehow need that area or that it belongs to them. Well, it doesn't at all. And they've got no right to it whatsoever. And there never was any Jewish temple there, and they should just leave it alone and let Muslims are pro there. So it's terribly important that we get the history sorted out and don't accept the fictional Jewish claims for a sample that never existed. Right, next. Here is what, this is the top of Mount Moriah. So Mount Moriah just peeps through here onto the Temple Mount. This is within the Dome of the Rock mosque or temple. This is an octagonal building. The Christian tradition is that there used to be an eightfold building here, as this is where Jesus would have stood whilst being interrogated by Pontius Pilate. So that's the Christian view. And here is the mosque which Muslims built. Here is it, a Jewish claim. Wikipedia says this is the Holy of Holies as a spiritual junction of heaven and earth, the Axis Mundi. They're trying to collect.
There's almost a facial feature there, Nick, you know, so two slits for eyes, what could be a nose toward the bottom, hair at the top, almost like a face.
Could be, yeah. Well, people imagine a lot. There's been more bloodshed around this whole area than probably anywhere else on Earth. Endless, terrific, holy battles, you know. The Old Testament describes where David built the temple. It's something to do with threshing floor, where a farmer was threshing his wheat, and David tried to buy it off him. Well, you wouldn't have the threshing floor at the top of a mountain. It's just inconceivable. So I think that's a clue to where the temple didn't exist. Okay, so that's inside what is now the Islamic mosque. Right. We've really covered this. Herod the Great ruled from 37 to 4 BC, and he had a load of private money, and he thought he could please the Jews, and so he did up their temple, but as we'll see, it certainly wasn't here on that particular site, and we need to stop fantasizing about that. It was at a place where there was a spring. There has to be a spring of water by a Hebrew temple, because the priests have to be able to perform their ablutions, so on. Okay, next. Now, with the Great War or Siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the Romans got really, really annoyed with the Jews. I mean, and they surrounded Jerusalem, and about 1 million Jews were wiped out. And some people doubt this huge number, but they're quite reliable sources, Tacitus and Josephus, ancient historians. At Passover, Jews have instructions. They all have to come into Jerusalem and get their, you know, lamb and cook it and slaughter it and eat it. So the population greatly swells up. And anyway, there was a siege of Jerusalem then. And what happened was that Jerusalem was leveled. They destroyed everything. They utterly destroyed the temple of Jerusalem, as Jesus in the Bible predicts, that he says there will not be one stone left on another. So that is how it came about that Jews forgot where it was. Now, this is a diagram which puts together different parts of historical time to try and explain things. Here is the Temple Mount, and you can see on it the mosque, where they put the mosque, okay? And then you can see back due south of it, the old city of David. That is the walled city. And at the top is an image of where the temple would presumably have been. The northern part of the old city. There's a gap between the old city of Jerusalem and the huge Temple Mount, okay? And all down the south, the east side is what's called the Kidron Valley. That might help you to picture the relation between these two different locations. Right, next. Okay, well, we've covered this. This is the great dream, what Jews are preparing for now. Donald Trump is sort of kind of helping them a bit, and there's a whole lot of rituals they have to go through. And they're preparing all the exact cloths they think they need, and presumably they're planning to start animal sacrifices again, as it says in the Old Testament. So this is a nightmare vision, and it's terribly important to stop them getting on with this nightmare vision, help them to realise that firstly, the original temple that never existed, and secondly, the temple that did exist wasn't there. It was in the old city of Jerusalem. Okay, next. Right. Now, how is it possible that Jews lost the track of their special temple? We found, as I said, Herod the Great starts to rebuild the temple, 20 BC, finds it a fairly shabby, rundown structure, and he makes it much bigger, gleaming with white marble and gold. Tacitus records, he's a Roman historian, in Jerusalem there's still a temple of immense wealth. Firstly came the city with its fortifications, then the royal palace, then within the innermost defences, the temple itself. Okay? So that is within the defences, that's the wall of old Jerusalem. And it's somewhere next to the royal palace of Jerusalem. So it definitely cannot be the Temple Mount. Right, and then in the Luke Gospel, Jesus says, look, not one stone will be left on another. So those are, as it were, those are just some accounts that we have of this ancient temple, which did really exist. Okay, next. Okay, now the key to the location of the temple that did really exist in the time of Jesus is the spring of water.
Nick, hold that thought. We have one final break, and we return with Nick Hollerstrom on the mythical, legendary history of the Temple Mount and related issues. We'll be right back.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building. Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Revolution Radio needs your help. Remember, it's all listener supported. Go to revolution.radio, revolution.radio, and you'll find options to support this program and all the others we have here. I am a huge fan of Revolution Radio, and I encourage you to give thought to taking the option, exercising your right to support this ongoing effort to expose the truth for the benefit of you and other Americans. We need to know our true history if we are to know what we can do or should to preserve it. I'm completing now my interview of Nick Holerstrom about the Temple Mount and related issues and the mythical history of the nation of Israel. Nick, please continue.
Okay, Jim. We've been looking at the amazing amnesia for 2,000 years of where the great temple, the Jews in Jerusalem, was located, and seeing how the very thorough destruction which the Romans perpetrated in 70 AD to wipe out, basically wiped out the city of Jerusalem, and then the memory, because the Temple Mount was the only thing remaining, people kind of imagined that maybe that's where the temple was. But a Hebrew temple, first of all, wasn't built on the top of a mountain. And secondly, it had to have a spring of fresh water for the ablutions, because all the animal sacrifices that were done there, the rabbis had to be able to access to running water. Okay, now I'll just go through these sources. 150 BC, that's the very earliest source we have. Aristeas says in the Temple of Jerusalem, there was an inexhaustible supply of water because an abundant natural spring gushes up from the temple area, as a letter he wrote about Jerusalem. The book in the Old Testament, Joel, says, a fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord. That's an account of the temple. The book of Ezekiel says, a sort of visionary book, then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple facing east. So that's some sort of memory of what the temple in Jerusalem was like. And then the Roman historian Tacitus, about 100 AD, Jerusalem, that sort of temple of immense wealth, a city, the royal palace, the temple itself within the innermost defences, it contains an inexhaustible spring. All right, that's a Roman historian. That's him remembering what the temple had been like. He's writing after it had been destroyed. Okay? So now here we come back to, this is an imaginary map of ancient Jerusalem, and it's showing you where the palace was and where the temple must have been. And it must have been near to what is called now the Gihon Spring. Okay, next. Okay, here is a modern reconstruction of putting together these different parts. There's the Temple Mount. You can see where the mosque is now. Okay? So this is a source which agrees with the story I'm telling here. It says the false location of the temple there was actually a Roman fort. And it's pointing out true location of the temple, which is the northern part of the ancient city, walled city of Jerusalem, what's called the City of David. The temple has to have been there, has to be next to the palace and next to that spring of water. Okay? So, and you can see there's a few hundred yards in between them. This is a quite a lively, fun to read Robert Cornuke book, which I recommend, where the temple really was. He's a sort of intrepid investigator. And Jim, would you like to read this out?
Sure. Paintings, renderings, and models of the temple today all show a glorious white-pillared temple perched on top of a 36-acre Temple Mount platform. And then they awkwardly add a small, almost unnoticeable Roman fort at the northwest corner. Why would the Romans, who were controlled perfectionists, allow a Jewish worship center to be constructed that is far mightier in statue and defense bulwarks than their own much smaller fortress? Does anyone think that after building this huge castle-like structure for the Jews with thousands of massive stone blocks, some as large as a big truck, that they would then build a subordinate-sized fork and stick it in the corner like it would a tiny garage next to a sprawling mansion? The concept simply violates all logic.
Right. That's a very sensible review. And bear in mind, this location is where World War III might be triggered off. Any day now, Trump and various religious fanatics in Jerusalem might storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, decide they've got to take it over, and start trying to build their temple there. And it's based on a totally false history that never was, that never happened. And we need people like Bob Cornuke, who goes to Jerusalem and figured out where the temple really was. Okay, so I urge anyone, especially if you want to visit Jerusalem, to get a real perspective on where the ancient temple was. Right, next. So this was the Holocaust, the one Holocaust Jews have really experienced in their history, of an awesome and terrible destruction. Roman Jewish historian Josephus said, after the war, a visitor would wonder why a camp was built to guard such an empty and desolate area. So there was the Temple Mount, Roman camp, but no trace of the old city of Jerusalem. The Romans had destroyed it so thoroughly. A commander of Jewish resistance, 73 AD, Jerusalem is now demolished to its very foundations. Nothing left but the monument of it preserved, by the camp of those Romans that have destroyed it. That's Temple Mount, right? Now, later on, 3rd century, Eusebius writes, the Romans besieged Jerusalem and destroyed it in the temple there. The city was reduced to a Roman farm with cattle cultivated. So that's how come memory of the old temple was lost. Jews forgot where the temple was. Okay, it's only in modern times reconstruction that we're getting a picture of where it actually was. Next. Right. Here we've really seen this this very abnormal situation and wanting to pray to a wall. Now let's bear in mind what exactly this wall is they're all praying to. It's the wall of Fort Antonia, where the 10th Legion was stationed, which wiped out 1 million Jews at the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Okay, it wasn't just the 10th Legion. I think there's about three Roman legions altogether did that siege. But that is what they're praying to. They're praying to the wall of a Roman 10th Legion, Fort Antonia Citadel. In a way, one should laugh at them for doing this, because it's a totally absurd thing to do. and it's based on bogus false history, that they've got an imagination that somewhere behind that lies their Temple of Solomon, which it really doesn't, okay?
And men only, Nick.
Well, I think so, yeah. Let's hope the women have got the sense not to want to pray to a wall, you know. there's some terrific status about going there and saying a prayer to the wall and stuffing a prayer in the crack. It's a very, very degenerate practice, and I urge listeners not to do it. But I think if you can go there, I don't think I'll be allowed there, I think it would be a very awesome experience to see these wonderful megalithic monuments. Okay, next. So it got thousands of prayers stuffed in the walls. No comment. Okay, next. So the Pope, as if he doesn't even believe in his own religion now, is praying to a wall. I guess it's these huge bricks. They're so enormous. People feel reverence. Well, I should feel reverence. It's a very awesome awesome wall, you know, but for God's sake, don't pray to it, you know. Next. right, next. I said one place, Baalbek in Lebanon, you get a comparable vast megalithic structures. Likewise, we don't really know who built them. I suggest this is not Rome. I suggest this is pre-Roman. That's what I'm suggesting. Okay, next. Right, now, lastly, when Jerusalem was founded, Israel founded in 948, it was founded on the basis of a fake history, as the modern Hebrew professor Shlomo Sand has pointed out for us in his great work, The Invention of the Jewish People, which I recommend you all get a copy of. So it says, after being forcibly exiled from their land, the people, that's the Jewish people, kept faith with it throughout their dispersion and never ceased to pray and hope for their return to it. Okay? That they'll be allowed to come back again. Jews strove in every success to re-establish themselves in their ancient homeland. Now, what Shlomo Sand has found out is that the Romans, although a lot of people were killed in Jerusalem, there was no dispersion or diaspora. The Jews were not expelled from the Holy Land. And what this means is that people in Palestine now are the original descendants of Judea. Okay? The people being exterminated today, that's the nearest thing you have on this earth of the original inhabitants of Judea. And the people doing the extermination who've moved into Israel, what's nowadays called Israel, are not basically Semitic people. So Shlomo Sand is saying that that claim of declaration of independence by Israel is based on a historical misconception that the Romans expelled Jewish people from Israel, from Judea. Okay, next. I think we need a lot more discussion of this thesis, whereby the exile didn't happen, right? The Palestinians are the real center of Judea, and they are Semitic people. And the Ashkenazi who come from East Europe, from the Khazars, who've moved into Israel, they keep pretending to be Semitic, but they're not really. So, if they have a right to come back to be in the Holy Land, I would say maybe let them have what originally was Israel. It's quite a small little area, but they have no right whatsoever to take over the whole of Palestine, which is what they're trying to do now. Okay. Right. I think that's all. Is that all?
Nick, I want to address that final point with you in greater detail, namely that the modern-day inhabitants of Israel are not descendants of the tribe of Judah. They're actually Khazarians. They're from the Former Atlantic Hazaria, now a part of modern-day Ukraine, where I have long since concluded that the war was fought because the plan was to make Ukraine the new Israel, that the modern-day inhabitants would actually return to the land of their ancestry, but that having been defeated by Russia in that effort, they're now ethnically cleansing Palestine in order to take control of the entirety of the area, even though their claim is very limited of short duration, while the Palestinians go back thousands of years. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, that's quite feasible, Jim. As you say, Khazaria did extend into eastern Ukraine. This is ancient history, the beginning of Russia and the end of Khazaria, Khazarian Empire. Very little documented for what Khazaria was, but yeah, it does seem. Shlomo Sands echoed the argument earlier put forward by Arthur Koestler in his book, The 13th Tribe, that the latter-day Jews in Europe are primarily Khazars. They don't have an Abraham gene in them. That's one thing Shlomo Sands is concerned to refute, the idea that there's any genetic linkage of people in Israel today with the Jews or Jews in the Holy Land. He says that has not really been shown, except maybe for some of the African Jews, the darker skinned ones who may be more Semitic.
With the case being made by South Africa before the International Court of Justice, which is the highest legal echelon of the United Nations, where I expect, given the voluminous, detailed evidence and assertions by the highest-ranking Israeli officials, including the prime minister, the president, the head of the Israeli armed forces, that they want to rid Palestine and Palestinians, I find it inconceivable the court will not find against Israel in favor of South Africa. But
let's hope you're right, Jim. Hope you're right. Yeah, right.
But Netanyahu has already declared it doesn't matter. He doesn't give a damn that they're going to continue with their extermination program regardless. Nick, your thoughts?
Well, the tribe has an amazing ability to put their own views, make people believe and accept their own views. That's the strange power they have. And I think it's terribly important for us, therefore, to look at this real history, which I've tried to describe, whereby fictional narratives are put over onto people. And I'm trying to argue that Christians should not believe everything said in the Old Testament about this glorious empire, which didn't matter in the past, but now that Jews are claiming they've got the right to the whole of Palestine, that illusory fictional image is one we have to deconstruct. It's terribly important to deconstruct it now and say that they do not have any kind of right of return. Firstly, because Israel did not exist in the first place. Secondly, because even if it had, they are not the descendants of Israel, Judea. They are Khazars in Russia and East Ukraine who converted. So I think we need some sort of movement of historical truth which will take away from them their right to use these fictional narratives. As you say, the case before the ICJ at the moment should be totally conclusive. It should be an open and shut case. But the tribe has a very strange and remarkable ability to impose its account of imaginary accounts of what happened on people. But at the same time, let me say, Jews are very intellectual people. And because of this, by their own intellectual reasonings, they must come to understand that these historical narratives are untrue based on their massive amount of of digging up the past, archaeology in the Holy Land, which has effectively refuted these ancient narratives.
Of course, the extreme Zionist view is they don't have to follow international law. The Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, those are merely the laws of man, that they're following a higher law, God's law, that they are the chosen people and that they're entitled to the promised land. And if you follow admonitions in the Old Testament, for example, genocide was a policy that God himself frequently recommended to the Jews by their account.
I'll find that sounding, yeah. It is terrible the way Christians seem to want to endorse the ethics of the Old Testament God, but let's not get into all that. Zionism was based on the dream of parts of Judea. They had a right to come back and take parts of Judea. Well, what parts of Judea? If they'd just taken what was ancient Judea, there might have been a case for it. But we've looked at the map, that they've grabbed far, far more than was ancient Judea. So I think we need a bit of historical realism here in saying, take your hands off this land. You've got no right to it.
Is it possible that Netanyahu, given all the, the likelihood of a negative judgment coming from the International Court of Justice, might make a move against the Temple Mount as a form of distraction to incite the citizens of Israel on his behalf and, in essence, perhaps ignite a world war, a religious war between Muslims and Jews that's going to draw in the entire world?
Well, this is where what you and I fervently believe in, which is informed discussion, needs to take place instead of bloodshed and rage. I mean, it's also easy to envision a scenario where attacks take place and Muslims fight back in rage and it just triggers off a conflict. And the Christians stay out of it because these days they're not so much bothered about their religion. Well, they need to be part of it. We need to have a three-way discussion, informed discussion, about who has a right to what. And after World War II, Jerusalem was divided up into three on the grounds that the three monotheistic religions had a claim to it. And I think we should try and keep that three-way division. It's totally wrong of Trump to make Jerusalem the capital of
Israel.
Israel or whatever. He has no right to be that. And we need informed discussion trying to explain to Jews that they never did have a temple there. That may seem a remote possibility, but I think that's what we have to believe in, yeah.
Well, I am by and large a supporter of Donald Trump, and I believe that he's the only political figure in America who can right the ship of state if he's returns to a second term as president. He has made any number of moves in relation to Israel, of which I disapprove profoundly, including moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, declaring the Golan Heights to be part of Israel, even defunding the U.N. organization dedicated to supporting Palestinian refugees. Those were all despicable, not to mention, of course, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani at the airport in Baghdad, which was offensive and immoral and illegal and violative of Iraqi sovereignty and perfidy by the United States, which had lured him there on the pretext of participating in a peaceful issue. I find that just profoundly objectionable, Nick. And, this man is, in my opinion, severely scarred by these acts of malfeasance of the past.
Well, it certainly is, let's not go into who should be the next year's president. I'm just saying that we should try to keep Jerusalem divided up amongst different religious traditions. And not let Jews think they've got some sort of right to take it over. They absolutely haven't. Israel vanished at 722 BC and never existed since. And it has no right to claim Jerusalem is part, should be part of it. I urge Christians to be more assertive on this matter and not to believe that Old Testament text in the same way. And we need to try and find a way of having a peaceful Jerusalem. And that's actually what I think the original root meaning of Jerusalem, it means the city of peace. CLM as the PIS. So let's try to have discussions without fundamentalist Judaism thinking it can take over, which you can only do if Christians take back seats or think they can be bossed around. I urge them not to do that. Let's have conferences in Jerusalem about what really happened.
Well, Nick, this has been a masterful presentation. I cannot thank you enough. I believe the fate of the world may hinge on who does become the next president of the United States. Trump has been a non-interventionist. He's wanted to have friendship with Russia. He does not want or support wars. I believe he would get us out of NATO and make other measures that would contribute to world peace, and therefore I support him with great vigor and enthusiasm in spite of what I judge to be some serious mistakes of the past, because as far as I can see, Nick, he's the only one who holds a promise of righting the ship of state. Nick, you're wonderful. I so admire all your work, all your efforts on so many different fronts. I welcome your final comments here for our audience in the wake of today's presentation.
Well, I think that's about it, Jim. The past history is crucially important for us. Don't wait for some experts to come in and say what's what. I urge truth groups to get together and discuss these matters and just be assertive. We've got to make a claim that some political basis for these ancient conflicts.
Special thanks to Nick Kohlerstrom. I encourage all of you to support. Spend as much time with your family, your friends, the people you love and care about. We do not know how much time we have left. Thanks. Nick,
join me on the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Industrial Complex podcast here on Revolution Radio, Studio B, every Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Get fit, empowered, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
My name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion.